Benjamin Norton Bugby, Sacramento Champagne King, written and spoken by Kevin Knaus. Chapter 8, Wine, Brandy, Champagne, Music, 1869 to 1872. How does a man regain his footing after losing an indispensable partner and wife? On U.S. Census data of the time, the occupation of the wife was often listed as keeping house. The maintenance of the home, meal preparation, and other domestic duties was a full-time job. Bugby was a busy man. If he was not managing the vineyard, overseeing the production of spirits, constructing more production facilities, attending meetings of the various philanthropic organizations he belonged to, or participating in local political party meetings, he was spending innumerous hours on the road just traveling between all the different functions. Martinetta McClashan. At a minimum, Bugby needed a housekeeper and cook. We can also assume that he wanted female companionship, if for nothing more than little conversation between meeting his business and social obligations. Less than 4 months after the death of Mary Jane, at the age of 43, Bugby remarried on August 23, 1869. His new wife was 26 years old and the daughter of Peter McClashan. The McClashans had moved west after Martinette's mother died in 1849. They settled in Sonoma County, where Martinette's older sister had remarried and was living in Healdsburg. In 1868, Peter was living in Sacramento County in Lee Township near Daler's Ranch, adjacent to the Cosumnes River. Martinette's sister, Adelia, had married George Washington Bayliss, who was farming in the area and keeping a boarding house. It's unknown how Bugby became acquainted with Peter McClashan. It is possible that Peter had been working in the vineyards in Sonoma County and perhaps worked for Bugby. Later in 1870, Bugby would sell part of his Duroc vineyard land to George Bayliss, who in turn sold it to Peter McClashan. Regardless of how they met, Bugby was once again married. His new bride was now married to a prominent vineyard owner and wine producer. Martinette Nettie McClashan was like Bugby, in that she wanted more out of life. She would go on to earn her teaching credential and become a school principal. But at this very busy period in Bugby's life, the main focus was on keeping house and attending to Benjamin. If Bugby spent much grieving over his deceased wife or reveling in his new marriage, it was not reflected in reports of his business or social life at the time. The one area of his life that he curtailed was running for public office. At the 1869 Union Republican County Convention, he was again asked to run for sheriff. James McClatchy made a motion that all the candidates come forward and pay their $5 assessment and give a short speech. Bugby paid his $5 and then declined the nomination. He said that he had heard that no man who had been sheriff could ever get nominated again. So far, this had proven correct in his case and with McClatchy. He noted how most of his attention was focused on his vineyard and thanked the convention for honoring him with such a nomination. Period of expansion. Bugby was expanding his storage capacity for the thousands of bottles of wine, brandy, and sparkling wine he was producing. In November 1869, Charles and Frank Wheeler sold Bugby a lot on Wool Street in Folsom, next to Connor's Flouring Mill on Wool Street. The mill was a three-story brick building that ceased operation in 1868. The third floor of the building, which fronted Sutter Street and was at a higher elevation, was rented as a meeting space for local organizations. Bugby used the bottom floors as a wine cellar. Bugby knew some of the best marketing was done by personal testimonials and recommendations. It was even better if the recommendations came from a noted politician or influential businessman. In July of 1869, Bugby sent 3 barrels of his red wine back east on the newly finished Transcontinental Railroad. 1 barrel went to the President of the United States, another to California Senator Conness, and a third to C.P. Huntington, Vice President of the Central Pacific Railroad. While it is not known how the men favored the Natoma Vineyard wine, the shipment did garner a story in the local newspaper. Freight costs were an issue at one of the first meetings of the newly formed Fruit Growers Association held in San Francisco in July 1869. The railroad companies were charging $100 per ton to ship fruit to Chicago. Grapes were averaging 10 cents per pound. agricultural producers were beginning to get a taste of the monopolistic pricing practices the railroad companies were employing. Bugbee was part of the organizing force behind the Fruit Growers Association and was selected as vice president in the summer of 1869. Later in the summer, Bugbee hosted Benjamin P. Avery, founder of the Marysville Appeal, who was then an editor of the Evening Bulletin out of San Francisco. Avery, who was a very prolific and descriptive writer of the California landscape, was observing the changes to the region from all the new agricultural endeavors. After a tour of the Natoma vineyards, the two Benjamins rode up to the new Japanese immigrant colony south of Coloma on Gold Hill. The Wakamatsu Tea and Silk Farm Colony were planting mulberry trees to provide food for their silkworms. No sooner was Bugbee getting settled in with his new wife when he was struck again by fire in October 1869. This time, it was purely by accident from a neighbor whose brush fire got out of control. While the vineyard was not touched, Bugbee's prized house on the hill overlooking the ranch was destroyed. Completed in 1868 at a cost of $30,000, house and furniture were insured for only $21,000. Bugbee would not rebuild the home, but he did keep expanding the winery. In the same month that his house burned, Bugbee started the expansion of his operations with another wine cellar, 22 feet wide, 160 feet long, and 2 stories tall. Bugbee enjoyed fruit trees. He had oranges and figs at the Natoma Vineyard. In the beginning of 1870, he planted several rows of eastern chestnut trees. The hope was to get a harvest in approximately 3 years. It is never easy to discern the personality of a historical figure in its fullness. Fortunately, there are little crumbs of interest that display Bugbee's nature and humor. He was enjoying the relative celebrity of being an outspoken and engaged vintner. But he also did not take himself so seriously that he couldn't have fun with visitors to his vineyard or the marketing of his wines. The California Farm and Journal of Useful Sciences noted how Bugbee had labeled some of his sparkling wines: Sieb Gub or Private Cuvée de Amatan. The label for his champagne stated Sieb Gub or Private Cuvée de Amatan. The translations are Bugbee's and Natoma spelled backwards. The label was a subtle acknowledgment that French sparkling wines or champagne still enjoyed the perception that they were superior to the emerging California product. So if you could not taste exactly like a French champagne, Bugbee felt he could at least sound like one. This, no doubt, must have given him a chuckle while introducing his Sieb Gub Cuvée de Amatan to the person with no French language skills and a wry inside joke to those who knew the sparkling wine market. The article also noted that by May 1870, several thousand gallons of wine were now being stored at the flouring mill he bought in Folsom. Feher Sogos questioned, "For all of Bugbee's vineyard management skills and mechanical ingenuity at constructing a winery, he wasn't a pomologist. He identified a grape varietal for raisin and wine production, Feher Sogos, whose provenance was suspect. At least it was to other men who had studied viticulture." In 1870, people started questioning whether Bugbee's Feher Sogos was the appropriate variety and, if it was, the actual suitability it had for raisin and wine production. The California Farmer and Journal of Useful Sciences republished a stinging rebuke of the Bugbee grape by a Utah pomologist. "This so-called grape, Feher Sogos, that for several years caused such a stir among viticulturalists in California under the auspices of Mr. Bugbee and others, has finally gone the way of thousands of other humbugs. In the first place, there is no authority that any grape by that name exists anywhere, only in the imagination of a few who have made that grape a specialty. The real name for the grape is the White Romaine, which we have imported from the East and fruited, and find it identical both in vine and fruit." The journal added, "The fruit of this vine, when fully ripe, is very delicate and nice for table use, but will make neither good wine nor a suitable raisin. The worst point it has is its disposition to crack and rot, a difficulty we have not been able to find a cure for. For the last 5 years, we have known the grape and have not found it to justify the hopes entertained for it in one case in 20. We would therefore advise our readers to plant it sparingly, for there are many varieties obtainable far superior which have not this great fault. Another vineyard owner also wrote to concur with the Utah pomologist's assessment of the Fajer Segos grapes. He asserted that the Fajer Segos would not make a good raisin, and it was locally known as White Malmsey. He contended that the only grape that would make a good raisin was the White Muscat d'Alexandre. The California Farmer and Journal of Useful Science was diplomatic in its response. After all, Bugbee was a local advertiser in their publication for his grape cuttings and wines. They noted that since the Fajer Segos introduction at the first State Agricultural Society fair in Sacramento, they reported that the actual name was White Malaga, the same variety which comes from the eastern United States. The journal parted ways with the pomologist and wrote, "When grown in proper soil and rightly cultivated here in red land or are decomposed quartz, it makes large clusters and fine raisins." They opted not to comment on the value of the grape as a foundation for superior wine. Perhaps Bugbee realized that his wines were the best amongst a mediocre lot that were being produced in California at the time. The United States Agricultural Department, when analyzing wines from California, noted the number of samples that had spoiled due to improper handling or corking. Bugbee may simply have been better at bottling his wines than other producers, to such a degree that Bugbee's mediocre wines were still superior to a bottle of spoiled wine from Napa. Products of the vine whose qualities are influenced less by soil, climate, and aging are those which are distilled or produced for relatively quick consumption. Consumers of sparkling wine were less apt to be finicky about a product's sensory elements than a connoisseur of fine wines. Champagne, or sparkling wine, was a festive alcoholic beverage and not subject to professional criticisms about the type of grape varietal used or its suitability. Bugbee had received enough mediocre reviews of his wines to realize he needed to shift markets. Instead of trying to please wine critics, he decided to move into fermented and distilled products that commanded similar prices without the headaches of snooty wine drinkers. Hugo Yonke Mansfeldt. In 1864, a young man by the name of Hugo Yonke settled in Sacramento. He would become the principal pianist and organist at the Congregational Church on 6th Street. Yonke was born in Prussia, commonly referred to as Germany, in U.S. documentation in 1844. His family lived in Bromberg, near the Polish border, and immigrated to New York in 1860. The family was of modest means. While his father concentrated on being a tailor, Hugo picked up work as a clerk. This allowed him enough money to buy some sheet music to continue playing the piano, a skill he had begun to cultivate before the family left Germany. Once Hugo had mastered the music he had bought, he started giving piano lessons to his siblings and other children in the neighborhood. In 1863, Hugo, with a friend, had the opportunity to accompany a piano on a ship bound for California. At the age of 19, and with little money, he embarked on a 5-week voyage at sea and land. He arrived in San Francisco in February 1864 and immediately went to M. Gray's Music Store. At Gray's Music Store, he learned that a piano teacher in Sacramento was permanently leaving and the city would be a good place for him to teach piano. The next day, he traveled to Sacramento and introduced himself at Dale's Music Store. There, Hugo learned that the Congregational Church was installing a new pipe pedal organ and needed an organist. Even though he had never played an organ, he interviewed for the organist position, concealing his lack of knowledge about playing an organ, and was hired for the job. In his autobiography, Hugo Yonke Mansfeldt discusses his anxiety about accepting the organist position. Not only had he no experience playing a pedal pipe organ, he soon learned that he was expected to perform a solo piece for a big concert celebrating the new organ. To make matters worse, the organ had not even been installed, so he could not practice on it. Hugo rushed down to the music store and was able to buy a book on how to play an organ. He practiced the piece on the piano, but that was no replication for playing the organ because he also had to push the pedals with his feet on the organ to fill the air bladders that drove the compressed air over the tubes to make the musical notes. On the day of the concert, he managed to get in 1 hour of practice while another organist from San Francisco, who was also performing that evening, watched him play. Hugo was to play the final piece of music that evening, while the visiting San Francisco organist played before him. He sat stunned as the San Francisco organist began to play the musical piece Hugo had been practicing. As a testament to Hugo Yankee Mansfeld's musical genius, the 20-year-old strode to the organ, sat down, and calmly improvised for 5 minutes. No one in the audience could tell that Hugo was literally playing by the seat of his pants. Yankee's musical career blossomed in Sacramento. In addition to his duties at the Congregational Church, he worked with the Philharmonic Society and began teaching students in pianto, choral, and individual singing lessons. In 1864, he married Annie Sanderson in Sacramento, also a musician, who would perform with him on occasion. Until he moved to Marysville in 1870 to open up a singing school, Yankee was either performing in concerts or organizing his own concerts that were staged at the Congregational Church, Metropolitan Theater, Agricultural Pavilion, and the Good Templars Hall in Folsom. He was able to recruit musical talent from the San Francisco area to perform in his concerts in Sacramento. The concerts were usually a mix of classical, contemporary, and patriotic music and songs. At the young age of 26, while he was building his musical career, Hugo decided to change his name. The correct translation of his family's last name was Yankee, J-A-H-N-K-E. As Hugo noted in his autobiography, they found the name was mispronounced in New York because people could not soften the J in the pronunciation. So they changed it to Yankee, Y-A-N-K-E. Unfortunately, this was further mispronounced as Yankee, as in Yankee Doodle Dandy. When Hugo landed in California, he was told the state leaned toward the Confederacy. He was also informed that Sacramento was a town that favored the Democratic Party, which, as the Civil War was finally coming to an end, was aligned with the Southern Confederacy. However, being called Yankee, with its northern connotations, was not the primary reason for changing his last name. As the principal organist for the Congregational Church, organizing concerts and instructing numerous students in piano, Hugo Yankee was a familiar face traveling around Sacramento. Since his father's primary trade was as a tailor, he inherited the disposition of always being professionally dressed in a suit when he traveled on horseback to teach his pupils. Hugo recounts the story in his autobiography, "But the real reason for my changing my name was this. Sacramento was then only a city of 20,000 inhabitants. As I was prominent, musically, many knew me. I used to ride horseback to give my lessons, and as nearly every street boy knew me by sight, they used to yell after me the well-known lines, 'Yankee Doodle Dandy went to town, a riding on a pony, stuck a feather in his cap, and called it macaroni.' The thought of Hugo's children being taunted by mean-spirited children when they went to school was too much for him. When he moved to Marysville in 1871, he petitioned his name to be changed to Mansfeld. Hugo selected Mansfeld because, as he explained, at the time all of the great pianists came from Germany. In hindsight, many decades later, Hugo still believed he made the correct choice to change his name, as, "I know that my two boys escaped many unpleasant incidents by changing of the name." Musical marketing. Musical concerts were a staple of entertainment in most towns in the 1860s, and Sacramento was no exception. Bugbee attended musical concerts and helped organize many for fundraisers and celebrations for the various social organizations he belonged to. Before Hugo changed his last name to Mansfeld, he was performing in Sacramento and Folsom as Hugo L. Yankee. Bugbee had most likely attended concerts where Yankee performed. He had probably also heard Gungel's Railroad Gallop, composed for the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad and performed at the 1869 Mechanics Industrial Fair. There was also the music Railroad King's Gallop, where the images of men who organized different railroad lines were illustrated. What better way to immortalize yourself and market your product than having a piece of music composed to promote and complement the consumption of champagne? Yankee accepted a commission from Bugbee to compose the Bugbee Champagne Gallop with a patriotic release date of July 4, 1870. on the cover of the sheet music for the Gallop. Surrounding the center illustration of Bugby is a wreath of grapevines with tendrils meeting at the top. On the right side of the Bugby portrait is a champagne flute overflowing like a volcanic eruption. To the left is a bottle of champagne blasting out its cork, similar to a 4th of July firework cannon. A gallop is a spirited piece of music with a beat similar to a running gait of a horse or a railroad train. It is fun to listen to, but not necessarily suited for more staid celebrations. For more sophisticated events, Bugby had Yonke compose the Bugby Champagne Waltz, which was published in 1871. Instead of the 2-4 timing of the Bugby Gallop, the Champagne Waltz was written in a 3-4 tempo. On September 16, 1870, Yonke performed Bugby's Champagne Gallop at the Agricultural Pavilion at the 17th Annual State Fair. The pavilion was constructed in 1859 by the City and County of Sacramento. It stood at the corner of 6th and M Streets to accommodate the fairs of the State Agricultural Society. On that September evening, Bugby's Champagne Gallop was paired with classical pieces such as selections from Tranquilli by Rossini, Overture to Fra Diavolo by Auber, Cavatini from Lucrezia Borgia by Donizetti, music from Ernani by Verdi, and the Railroad Gallop. As was standard marketing practice for Bugby, he sent out bottles of champagne along with the musical score of the Gallop to various newspapers. The Daily Alta wrote, "The champagne is very musical, and the music very champagne, and both together may be appropriately classed among the few things which make life endurable and lighten the harden of the daily cares. It is hard to say whether the wine or the music is most enjoyable. In fact, they both bubble and sparkle together, and are both delicious." Whether it was intentional or not, the cover of the sheet music noted it was composed for and dedicated to B.N. Bugby, Esquire of Folsom, leading readers to assume that Hugo Yonke was so raptured by Bugby Champagne as to cause him to write a whole musical score in honor of it. The Sacramento Daily Union bought into the ruse by commenting, "We are not versed in music, but the reputation of Bugby's sparkling champagne is established, as one might well suppose, when it has inspired a composer to render it immortal by setting it to music and sending it down sparkling and foaming to posterity." Hugo Yonke was a talented young man living in Sacramento. He eventually found his way to the Bay Area to teach music and perform. In 1884, he returned to Europe to study with Franz Liszt at Weimar. He returned to California after 2 years of study and gained notoriety as a concert pianist, instructor, and authority on musical technique. At the same state fair where the Bugby Champagne Gallop was played, the vintner won awards for the best white wine, best sparkling wine 2 years old, and as usual, best exhibit of wines from a foreign grape. Natoma Vineyard and Winery Detailed. While Bugby claimed he spared no expense in modernizing and expanding his operations, this was California in the 1870s. People had to be resourceful, and that meant repurposing items for new uses. A large fire consumed the Granite Flour Mill on the north side of the American River, not far from the Natoma Vineyard, in 1867. The mill had been rebuilt after the 1862 floods that had virtually washed it away. The January fire closed the mill for good. However, the stone buildings, hollowed out by fire, still stood. Bugby bought the remains and carted them the short distance over to his vineyard. He then used them to construct a warehouse, 75 feet by 125 feet, to store his inventory. In August of 1870, Bugby purchased 20 large wooden tanks from the Central Pacific Railroad. The tanks had originally been constructed to hold drinking water for the men working on the railroad crossing the Alkali Flat of Nevada. Bugby's design was to use them as fermenting vats for the manufacturer for his brandy. Bugby had every reason to be proud of his success, vineyard, and winery. He was an excellent spokesperson for the emerging wine industry in California. He also had a talent for writing and a desire to document the facts. He collaborated with a correspondent from the California Farmer and Journal of Useful Sciences to provide a detailed and complimentary overview of the Natoma Vineyard operations in the publication's August 18, 1870 edition. Quote, the estate of which the Natoma Vineyard forms a part is 480 acres, of which there are now 125 acres in vineyards. 88 acres are in full bearing. The crop this year surpassing all other years in quantity and quality, the crop upon these vines being much greater than most vineyards and superior to any we know of in our state. And we can say with truth we have never seen the equal in this or any other part of the world. There are 37 acres also of vines not in bearing, being newly planted. The collection of choice grapes in this vineyard has no superior in the state, for in addition to the Mission grape, generally grown, the leading kinds are in the order of named, ranked in their quality as bearers, and also in the quantity grown. White Malaga this year bearing enormously, the vines being literally a mass of grapes. The vines will give from 40 to 75 pounds each, a most remarkable crop. The Red Tremina, also an immense crop, a mass of rich compact clusters, the Zinfandel, the Verdello, the Alicante, the Pinot, and the Riesling, Johannesburg, have all a splendid heavy crop each, and all these varieties Mr. Bugby finds will make superior wine. There are also Chasselet of Fontainebleau, Muscadine, Black Malaga, Homburg, Black Malvasia, White and Gray Riesling, Sweetwater, and Black Prince, all for wine together with Flaming Tokay, White Tokay, Cannon Hall Muscat, White St. Peter's, Homburg, Rosa Peru, White Nice, and Palestine for the table. Although each and all of these table grapes are excellent for wine, and when we shall remember that these choices of foreign grapes are here in open culture on the hillsides in our dry climate, and where most of the thermometer has actually run as high as 118 degrees, and yet in this vineyard there are thousands of clusters and well-shouldered bunches, 2.5, 3, and even 4 pounds each, is it not right for us to say that this showing has no superior? The vineyard made in the year 1868 40,000 gallons of wine. The present year, 1870, it is estimated the crop will give fully 125,000 gallons, and of the most superior quality, too, besides 8,000 gallons of the very best brandy. That some estimate may be formed of the work done and now in preparation for this great harvest. We can state, in addition to the long-range buildings and cellars of many hundred feet that are now being created in the most substantial manner of stone and brick, winehouses of the most approved form and style, some 200 feet long, 40 feet wide, and 30 feet high, 2 stories, no cost being spared to have them the best that genius, talent, and skill can produce. The standing casks now in process of being made ready for present harvest are as follows: 69 standing casks of 800 gallons each, 20 tanks of 100 gallons each, 20 tanks additional ordered made, equivalent to about 110,000 gallons. It is indeed most interesting to note the order, system, and purity in and around all the buildings. In the manufacture of the wines at this vineyard, the greatest care is paid to the preparation and the purity of the casks. The building being light, airy, and warm, the casks are more exposed to light and heat, therefore are of the best kind, and purely sweet and perfect. The greatest care is paid to the manufacture of these wines, and the reward for this care has been the high name already attained, both at home and abroad, for the wines of the Natoma Vineyard, or, as is said, the Bugby wine. The varieties of wine made are port, sherry, Chambertin, red and white wines, and hock. These all rank high and are quickly saleable at good prices, and the brandy being of extra quality is esteemed superior to much of the imported French brandy. The brandy made here is by the new process of distillation known as the Johnston's new process, by which the fusel oil is entirely extracted, rendering the brandy pure and of superior quality and of greatly increased value. This process is now attracting great attention, the proprietor, Mr. Bugby, being the first wine and brandy distiller who has introduced this process into practice, yet at great cost. Natoma Vineyard is 5 miles from Folsom. The average number of men employed through the year is 25. During harvest and winemaking, 40 hands are employed, of which for gathering grapes, etc. Some 25 Chinamen are employed who are considered competent, trustworthy, and faithful. Mr. Bugby is also owner of the Duroc Vineyard, which is 14 miles from Folsom. Duroc contains 200 acres, of which grounds only 20 acres are now bearing vines, and principally the same variety of grapes, the prospect being the same for this year. Both these vineyards are to be steadily increased in their acres of vines, just as the merits of the grapes are fully tested for making the best of wines, as the proprietor is determined that none but pure and valuable wines shall ever go from his vineyards. When it shall be remembered that for the foundation thus laid for these vineyards nearly $250,000 has been expended, all will perceive California is bound to be the vineyard of the world. Unquote. Any mention of the Fajer-Sagoz grape variety, whose identity had been questioned by so many others in the viticulture field, had been excised from the vineyard description. Instead, the grape varietal White Malaga is highlighted as the big grape producer. The article notes how, despite the 100-degree Fahrenheit-plus summer temperatures, the vines are producing large clusters of berries. The article also relates Bugby's belief that wine is best fermented and aged in warm, airy cellars, as opposed to those dark, cool, high-humidity caves over in Napa or Sonoma counties. The mention of a warm environment for fermenting and aging wine was included to counter the growing sentiment that cool, dark cellars are best. Vintners in Napa and Sonoma counties, using caves with cool temperatures and high humidity, were producing excellent wines. Because of the quality of the wines being produced in Napa and Sonoma County regions, the California Farmer and Journal of Useful Sciences was beginning to change their recommendations away from Bugby's method of warm and airy fermenting process. Big investment. Also noteworthy in the 1870 story on the Natoma Vineyard is the disclosure that a capital investment of over $250,000 had been poured into the vineyard and winery operations. Bugby was also investing in new equipment for brandy distillation. The Johnston method accelerated the removal of fusel oil that can impart bitterness to the brandy, which is normally broken down by aging the product. Hence, high-quality brandies were usually aged for 10 to 20 years before being released for sale. The reduced time it took to create product with the new Johnston distillation process meant that Bugby could get his brandy to market sooner. In the summer of 1870, Bugby shipped 10 rail car loads of 20,000 gallons of wine back east. He also decided to travel back east to promote his wines, visit with his family, and introduce them to his new wife. His good friends at the Journal heaped praise on Bugby in advance of his return to Connecticut. Mr. Bugby has been a most indefatigable worker as a vineyardist, converting the waste and dreary places of the mountain and valley into a garden, where the new wines gush like a river. After an absence of 20 years from his native home, he returns to greet his kindred and friends. He goes bearing with him the honorable evidence of his labor and untiring industry, of which he can be justly proud. Even the railroad companies were helping promote Bugby. In the marketing publication Lands of the Central Pacific Railroad, the railroad notes how Bugby is cultivating a new industry of the raisin grape on a piece of land purchased from the railroad near Folsom. Bugby purchased 120 acres from the Central Pacific Railroad in 1870. The property was south and adjacent to the Natoma Vineyard in Section 21 of Township 10 North, Range 8 East. He also purchased 40 acres from the Central Pacific Railroad at the same time at the Duroc Vineyard, Section 11, Township 9 North, Range 9 East. The land transactions were facilitated by E.H. Miller Jr. for the Central Pacific Railroad and signed by Leland Stanford. On his trip back east in Boston, Bugby learned of how inferior wines were being marketed as California varieties and was inspired to expose the imposters. Along the way, he picked up orders for more of his wines, brandy, and sparkling wine. In December of 1870, he shipped 4 more rail cars of wine back east. Bugby was even able to secure the first United States shipment of wine to Shanghai, China. Early in 1871, Bugby sent 150 cases of champagne and 28 casks of brandy to Nathaniel Perkins in Manchester, New Hampshire. Bugby had his marketing machine in high gear and was making sales. The future looked bright. It was time to invest further in the Natoma Vineyard operations and other distillery prospects. The Big Brandy Gamble. Bugby was producing his brandy with a new still invented by George Johnston of Sacramento. Several men, including Bugby, thought this new patented process was so superior and offered such a high rate of return on any investment that they formed a business association to raise $75,000 in capital to build a Sacramento distillery using the method. Shortly after the association meeting, Bugby hosted an event at the Natoma Vineyard so that interested investors and the press could witness the Johnston still in operation. The party of spectators left on the 615 Sacramento Valley Railroad train for Folsom. It was a gloomy, wet, and cold March morning. After breakfast in Folsom, the men boarded carriages for the one-hour ride out to the Natoma Vineyard. George Johnston was waiting for the party at the Natoma Vineyard and had prepared the fire under the boilers and charged one of the tubs of wine. A reporter for the Sacramento Daily Union gave the following description. Quote, "So much has already been said concerning the still by the press of this city and state that it is unnecessary on this occasion to give a lengthy description of its appearance. Suffice it, that is of copper, and it consists of a column of six chambers, reaching to a height of 12 or 18 feet. The lower chamber is about 4 feet in diameter and 3 feet in height. The other five chambers are, say, 2 feet in diameter and about 2 feet in height. Each chamber is a coil of pipe connected from one chamber to the other, leading from the top of the column to the bottom, and designed to be used in regulating the temperature of the still by means of steam of cold water passing through it. The exact temperature is ascertained by means of a thermometer set in the top of the column. Two wooden vats, strongly bound, each having a capacity of 800 gallons, act as the feeders of the still, with which they are connected in such a manner that while one is being used, the other can be cleansed and recharged. To facilitate the cleansing, each has a gate near the bottom through which the contents are sluiced out. One of these feeding vats being charged either with pumice, grapes, or wine, whatever material is intended to be used, steam is let on from the boiler, the pressure averaging about 2 pounds. As the temperature increases, the vapor from the vat passes into the lower chamber of the still and rises from one chamber to another and to the top, from whence it is led to a worm in a tank nearby for condensation. The still operates upon the simple principle that the fusel oil will vaporize at a lesser temperature than the acetic ether, and that in turn at a lesser temperature than the alcoholic spirit. In the experiment yesterday, the fusel oil was drawn off at about 160 degrees. To maintain this heat sufficiently long to allow the oil being thoroughly removed, a man is stationed at the top of the columns to watch the thermometer. If he finds that the heat increasing, he has recourse to a valve rod at hand by means of which he is able to let a greater or lesser quantity of cold water into the coil of pipe, as the necessity of the moment may demand, it being ascertained by the usual test that the fusel oil has come off, the temperature is increased to about 170 degrees until the acetic ether is also disposed of, being saved for redistillation, and then the heat being still further increased to about 177 degrees, the pure brandy, thoroughly distilled and rectified, is produced." Unquote. The demonstration produced brandy of 84% proof. The Johnston still was compared to another still at the winery, patterned after the French method of brandy distillation constructed by William Schmidt of Folsom. The reporter noted the size of Bugby's operation, along with his tremendous investment in the property, even after suffering heavy losses due to fires in years past. For the return trip, Bugby hired a special train to carry the men back to Sacramento. The value proposition of the Johnson Still was getting a drinkable product from still to table within months instead of years. Bugbee was selling three-month-old brandy using what must have been, for Bugbee, this glorious mechanical invention. He even garnered some positive press from the Sacramento Bee in light of the past feuds with editor James McClatchy. Bugbee was excited about the Johnson distillation process for brandy and wanted to share his experience with the Sacramento Bee. Of course, Bugbee was also an investor in the Johnson Still. Regardless, he reported that he was able to produce 50 gallons of drinkable brandy from 1 ton of grapes. Grapes at the time were selling between $20 and $25 per ton. Bugbee calculated his net cost to produce 1 gallon of brandy using the Johnston process at $3. Further, he was able to sell each gallon of unfinished product at $5 legal tender or $4.50 in gold coin. At this time, California's preferred monetary system was gold coins. Legal tender, or greenbacks printed by the U.S. government, were discounted. The East Coast, a market into which Bugbee was selling, used primarily greenbacks to pay for goods and services. In California, not only was gold coin the preferred payment method, it was also stipulated into contracts and mortgages that the debt would be repaid in gold coin. The net effect to California producers selling into the East Coast markets, or any market where they were reimbursed with greenbacks, meant gross revenue on sales was discounted when converted into gold coin. Sacramento philanthropy. That Bugbee would actually set foot in the offices of McClatchy Sacramento Bee after their bitter political feuds of the past is rather remarkable. But now both men belong to the Union Republican Party and could find common ground with shared political and social beliefs. At the beginning of 1871, James McClatchy was helping organize a social ball to raise money for the Howard Benevolent Association at the new county hospital. Bugbee was on the finance committee representing Folsom along with P.J. Hopper. Former Sacramento County Sheriff James Lansing, a friend of Bugbee's, was also on the supper committee. The Howard Benevolent Association, or Howard Association, was first organized in Virginia in 1855 during a yellow fever epidemic. The association raised money to pay for the hospital care of those afflicted by the disease. Sacramento's Howard Benevolent Association was chartered in 1857. Their mission was to raise money to pay for medical care at the county hospital for those who were too poor to pay for it. The Sacramento Howard Benevolent Association had a goal of collecting $1 per month from every Sacramento City resident. Association bylaws prohibited discussion of any religious or political topics at any of the meetings of the directors, a rule that probably helped men from different political backgrounds, as Bugbee and McClatchy were, participate in the organization. The winter of 1870 and 1871 was particularly difficult for the residents of Sacramento, as many had become ill and had to seek health care at the county hospital. To raise extra money to pay for the health care services of those who could not afford them, the Howards organized a fundraising dinner party at the Agricultural Pavilion. The event, comprised of music and supper, raised several hundred dollars for the Howards Benevolent Fund that evening. Natoma Water and Mining Company. The spring of 1871 may have been the high water mark for Bugbee's wine and spirits business. However, no one could predict the numerous little financial challenges Bugbee would face in the future. At age 44, Bugbee appeared to have struck the new California gold with his Natoma vineyard. He was even beating back large corporations from encroaching on his property. In March 1871, Bugbee prevailed against the Natoma Water and Mining Company, which had wanted to condemn part of his Natoma vineyard for the construction of a new flume for their water ditch. Three commissioners were appointed by a district court judge in Placerville to assess the damages Bugbee would suffer by ceding the property to the Natoma Water and Mining Company. The commissioners took testimony over 20 days and visited the Natoma vineyard. Bugbee testified that he had between 86,000 and 90,000 grapevines in production. He expected the vineyard to produce between 500 and 800 tons of grapes that he valued at $50 per ton. This was greater than the statewide average of $25 per ton. Bugbee mentioned the grapes from his Duroc vineyard operations were valued at $25 per ton after freight costs the Natoma vineyard to be processed. After reviewing the testimony, the three commissioners awarded Bugbee $19,000 for the loss of production as a result of the Natoma Water and Mining Company's new flume on his property. This worked out to approximately $2,000 per acre. Unfortunately, the action by the Natoma Water and Mining Company would not go away. They would continue to dispute the judgment and insist that they had a legitimate right to Bugbee's land because they were there first. Bugbee's finances, along with an estimated per-acre value of $2,000 in grapevines, had been so widely reported in the newspapers and journals that it spurred other landowners to plant even more grapevines. The reporting also produced an offer from a California liquor importing house to purchase a half interest in the Natoma vineyard for $100,000. Bugbee declined this offer. Just a year before, Bugbee had taken out a mortgage on the Natoma vineyard from Sacramento Savings Bank for approximately $15,000. Even though the Pacific Rural Press was complaining that savings banks were not lending to agricultural pursuits, Bugbee was able to get a loan to expand his operations. In 1871, Bugbee was just gearing up to accelerate his wine, sparkling wine, and brandy production. He had exclusive rights to use the new Johnston Still in El Dorado County to produce and bring drinkable brandy to the market in under a year. He saw his future as being very bubbly and very bright. Fire in politics. Unfortunately for Bugbee, the brightness of his future was dimmed by the light of a fire. In May 1871, fire struck downtown Folsom. It started at the store of Smith, Campbell, and Jolly and burnt down to the basement. Bugbee was using the bottom floor of the building he owned to store inventory. The building at the corner of Wool Street was close to the Sacramento Valley Railroad Depot. The origin of the fire remained a mystery, but Bugbee's loss was heavy. It was estimated that he lost $85,000 in the form of the building, wine, and brandy inventory, plus furniture. Bugbee only had $29,000 in fire insurance on the property and contents. Unlike the previous fire of the wine cellar at the Natoma Vineyard, Bugbee did not offer a reward for the arrest and conviction of the arsonist. That may have been the prudent course of action because the rumor amongst Folsom residents was that Bugbee set the fire. Shortly after the fire, Nathaniel Knight wrote to his brother Ambrose. Nathaniel described a terrible fire that consumed several buildings, leaving downtown Folsom with a wound that would take years to heal. He went on to express his opinion of the fire, noting, "Now I believe all this calamity is the work of an incendiary, a high muck-a-muck of a free and accepted mason. Bugbee just happened to be a mason." In a letter dated July 2, 1871 to Ambrose, Nathaniel does not hesitate to identify the suspected arsonist. Quote, "I believe the prevailing opinion is that B.N. Bugbee set fire to his wine house to get the insurance, as he was hard-pressed for money at the time. His insurance was $29,000, and his wine house worth about $5,000, and his wine perhaps $10,000. That would leave him $14,000 neat cash, a pretty little purse for burning $75,000 or $100,000 worth for his neighbors, but they were all heavily insured." Unquote. Bugbee was never charged for arson in relation to the fire that destroyed his wine cellar and several other buildings in Folsom in the spring of 1871. By June, Bugbee was preparing to rebuild the wine cellars he lost to fire. In an ironic occurrence, just a few weeks before the fire, Bugbee was appointed to the advisory board of the Craftsman's Life Insurance Company of New York for their California division. Perhaps it was his past experience with fire loss that garnered him the appointment. Not content with just running a burgeoning viticultural empire and reconstructing buildings destroyed by fire, Bugbee took another stab at being nominated for the office of sheriff under the Republican Party. In June, at the nominating convention, Mike Bright garnered 51 votes, Heilbronn captured 32, and Bugbee could only muster 14 votes. Not deterred by failing to receive the party's nod for sheriff, Bugbee remained active in county politics and was appointed to the Republican County Central Committee. One of the resolutions of the Sacramento County Republicans that must have pleased Bugbee was the declaration of uncompromising opposition to the granting of railroad subsidies to corporations or individuals. One of the issues was that the railroads received subsidies and were beginning to charge monopolistic freight rates. Brandy producers such as Bugbee were also levied a per-gallon tax on brandy spirit produced. New Folsom Home, C.T.H. Palmer. In July 1871, Bugbee sold a Folsom lot to a Chinese man by the name of Mum Singh. Described as the east half of Lot 3 in Block 19, the site fronted Leidesdorf Street and was just west of the Sacramento Valley Railroad Depot. Bugbee had bought the lot in 1862 from Gilbert Cole for $500. He sold it to Singh for $450. It was no secret that Bugbee employed Chinese men to work in his vineyard, but it may have been disconcerting to some Folsom residents that Bugbee had sold property to a Chinese man at a time when sentiment against Chinese immigrants in California was on the rise. There was no explanation as to why Bugbee made the sale to Mum Singh, whether it was for a business or residence. Regardless, Bugbee may have just needed to raise cash for his next move. With fire destroying Bugbee's Natoma Vineyard house on the hill, he decided to buy a large house in Folsom. In August 1871, he bought the former residence of Charles Theodore Hart Palmer, who was moving to the Bay Area after a long and profitable career in the Folsom region. Like Bugbee, C.T.H. Palmer came to California in 1849. Like Bugbee, he tried his hand at mining until he found other pursuits that were not as arduous and paid better money. Palmer's career in financial transactions began to take root when he became an express agent in Ophir, west of Auburn, California. In 1854, he established a Wells Fargo branch at Rattlesnake Bar. He would continue to move south, down the North Fork of the American River, opening offices at Doten's Bar and Carrollton, until he moved to Folsom in 1856. By 1860, C.T.H. Palmer was operating the Granite Banking House, managing an SA office, and handling express packages for Wells Fargo & Company. In 1859, Palmer constructed an iconic fireproof building with a street-facing wall made of granite blocks. After the Central Pacific Railroad Company had completed much of its line up to Auburn, Folsom began to decline as a hub of commerce. Palmer's wife had moved to Oakland, California for health reasons. With the decline of gold mining in Folsom, which in turn reduced the necessity of having a banking house to assay gold dust and convert it into Wells Fargo & Company checks, Palmer decided to move to the Bay Area permanently in 1870. Bugbee purchased Palmer's fine home on the corner of Bridge and Figueroa Streets, lots 7 and 8 in Block 53, in Folsom for $1,650 in August of 1871. The $1,650 purchase would seem modest for a man in Bugbee's financial situation as a successful vintner. Yet he apparently needed the financial assistance of Ann Johns, J.W. Spire, and J.M. Phillip to complete the purchase. Was this real estate loan, in addition to the sale of Mum Singh, an indication that Bugbee was having cash flow problems? Bugbee would make a curious Folsom lot purchase in September 1871. He purchased the eastern half of Lot 11 in Block 9 along Leidesdorf's and Reading Streets from R.W. Murphy for $100. Back in 1857, Bugbee had executed a quitclaim deed on Lots 10 and 11 to Murphy, along with other lots in Blocks 40 and 44 for $4,000. Underneath these lots, as the bluff sloped down to the river, Bugbee and others had tunneled drift mines. Was Bugbee trying to generate some revenue from gold mining? He did generate some money when he sold the eastern northern section of Lot 10 in Block 9 for $1,000 to Charles Nuttall and Stephen Addison in August 1872. Despite everything that Bugbee had going on in his life, including managing a winery, marketing, and real estate transactions, he still found time to exhibit at the 1871 State Fair. Bugbee's entries, those that weren't destroyed by the Folsom fire, were still winning awards. He received a premium for his white sparkling wine, best exhibit of wines, and best and greatest varieties of wine grapes. There were no awards for his raisins, but he may have not entered any in 1871, as he was devoting most of his crop to wine and spirits. However, Bugbee acknowledged the profitability of raisins. were it not for most of his capital and loans being directed at the production of wine and brandy, he explained to the Pacific Rural Press, he would expand his raisin production. In short, Bugby had placed all his money on the profitability of wine, sparkling wine, and a lot of capital for the Johnston still for the production of brandy. By the end of 1871, Bugby had produced 70,000 gallons of wine. The Pacific Rural Press noted that the prodigious amount of wine was made without irrigation. Bugby was still in litigation with the Natoma Water and Mining Company over the construction of the flume on his property. While Bugby may not have bought any water from the Natoma ditch, there was enough seepage below the earth-lined canal to provide plenty of irrigation water for his wine grapes. California State Fair Gold Medal Statements. The California State Agricultural Society broke up their entries and exhibits into different departments. The fifth department, in which Bugby exhibited, was made up of brandies, wines, butter, honey, and preserved pickles. Premiums were awarded to the best products. There could be several winners of the highest premium in a category. For example, Bugby received a $10 premium at the 1870 State Fair for his white wine, 1 year old. George West of Stockton and Orleans Hill Viticultural Society in Sacramento also received $10 premiums for their wines in the same category. After the state fair concluded, entrants in each department could submit a statement as to why their overall exhibits should be awarded the gold medal for the year. For 1870, Bugby submitted a short 3-paragraph statement for his wines. His main argument that he should receive the gold medal was that he had the largest exhibit of wines and brandies produced from foreign varieties of grapes. His second argument was less about the quality of his items rather than his investment in advocacy for wine production in California. Quote, "thereby showing conclusively the capacity of our soil and climate to produce successfully the finer wines of France, Germany, Spain, and other wine countries of Europe. The result has been effected through great care and expense, extending over a period of nearly 10 years, and is destined to have an important and favorable influence in competing with the finer varieties of wines, which have heretofore been imported from Europe. The undersigned claims that he has produced as fine qualities of wines from the different varieties of grapes used as can be had, age and other circumstances considered, anywhere, and that the result thus attained he has made the common property of all other viticulturists in the state, Benjamin Norton Bugby." Unquote. The State Agricultural Society Committee agreed with Bugby and awarded him the gold medal for wines and brandies. Awards were important for marketing purposes, and Bugby proudly announced his several gold medals in advertisements for his wines, brandies, and sparkling wines. The agricultural items comprising the different State Agricultural Society state departments were changed for the 1871 State Fair. Wines were now judged in the 6th department, along with grains, garden seeds, flowers, and fruits. Silk, its production, and the goods made from it was in the 3rd department. However, the Agricultural Society erroneously included silk in the same category as exhibits for wines and brandies. The committee reviewing entries for gold medals even acknowledged its embarrassment for what the members characterized as the imperfect classification of the different exhibits. The underlying logic was that wine, brandy, and products made of silk were manufactured from agricultural products and were not standalone commodities such as wheat, corn, flowers, or fruit. One of the elements for receiving a gold medal was the practical value of the agricultural entry to the state. For the 5th department, gold medal statements from J.R. Nickerson of Lincoln and the Orleans Hill Viticultural Society argued that both their previous awards and extensive investments into their vineyards showed they should receive the award. It was Bugby, in his statement, that specifically made the case that the wine industry was more important to California than the budding silk industry. At the 1871 State Fair, he had his largest number of entries, exhibiting 29 different wines, brandy, and champagne, plus displays of grapes and raisins. But there was a new and growing industry in California, silk production. At the San Francisco Mechanics Fair earlier in the year, the California Silk Factory had taken a gold medal for its raw, spool, and twisted silk produced on farm. There was also considerable promotion of silk production in California. In addition, people enjoyed seeing the silkworms on display, munching on mulberry leaves and spinning their little cocoons. Bugby could sense the mood at the state fair and at the agricultural society had shifted. Silk was the interesting commodity of the year. His 1871 statement was no less than a treatise of several pages in length questioning the economic worth of the silk industry to California, along with a history of his accomplishments and contributions to the wine and vine industry in California. His arguments were carefully crafted. Bugby praised the potential of the silk industry and acknowledged that California is perfectly suited for the production of mulberry trees to feed the little silkworms. But he noted that the silk industry and production were in their infancy and had not contributed to California like the wine industry had. Quote, "Hence the successful development of these new industries in our state will bring into use and make valuable millions of acres of a class of land that can in no other way be rendered of but little value. To the exhibitors of these particular classes in this department, then, the need of merit will doubtless be awarded, and while I would concede great merits to the pioneers and exhibitors in the silk industry, yet I think it will be admitted that sufficient has not been accomplished in silk culture to entitle the industry to rank before that of the cultivation of the vine and the manufacture of its products. The benefits to the state from silk culture are mostly in anticipation, while those from wine culture and wine manufacture are in a fair state of realization. This advanced stage of the latter has been brought about by the foresight, enterprise, and perseverance of a few individuals." Unquote. In his argument, Bugby noted that viticulture and winemaking were once dubious experiments and not guaranteed of success in the state. Advocates for the nascent California wine industry had worked hard to convince people that the state's wines were equal or superior to European imports. He then went on to argue that he should be awarded the gold medal based in part on his pioneering and experimental vineyard, plus his tireless promotion of the wine industry. Quote, "During this entire time, I have been constantly and carefully carrying on experiments, the object of which has been to determine, first, the varieties of grapes best adapted for making superior wines of the different kinds in California, and second, the best mode of treating those wines in this climate to secure the best results from any given variety. For the double purpose of assisting my own judgment as to the success with which these experiments were being attended, and to establish a reputation and market for California wines in general, and in my own in particular, I have taken a great deal of pains and spent a great deal of money in placing them on exhibition and competition with the wines of other producers at our own mechanics and state fairs, and also exhibited them at the Universal Exhibition at Paris in 1867. Unquote. Bugby then enumerates his 35 different awards from 1863 to 1871 for raisins, wine, sparkling wine, brandy, exhibits of grapes, and wine. Further, he reports that he also is at the forefront of brandy production with the construction of the first Johnston still. Quote, "In 1868, my attention was called to an improved still for the manufacture of brandy, patented by Johnson. Having satisfied myself that it was a good improvement, I built and set to work the first working still ever made under the patent. The venture proved a good to myself, and the introduction and general use of this still cannot fail to be of immense benefit to the vine interest and to the state. Whatever that benefit may be, it gives me no small degree of satisfaction that through my patronage as a vine grower, it was first introduced and proved of value. By the use of this still, the operator can by one operation clear the brandy of the fusel oil and acetic ether and retain all of the natural aroma. The same quantity of grapes or other fruits will make 20% more spirits than by the old process, with 25% less expensive." Unquote. He even lamented the monetary loss on his first attempts to produce sparkling wine. His experiments with producing champagne in 1868 cost him $12,000. The next year, he claimed he was able to produce a drinkable product. Bugbee's overall argument was that he should receive the gold medal for all he had done for the vine and wine industry, along with all his tremendous sacrifices. He noted his awards at the Mechanics Institute and how he had his California wines distributed across the country from St. Louis, Missouri to Buffalo, New York. In terms of specificity and stating the case for being awarded a gold medal at the state fair, Bugbee's statement was one of the most detailed and lengthy. Unfortunately, the State Agricultural Society awarded the gold medal to Edward Mueller of Nevada City for exhibition of the silk business. The Society's explanation was that they decided to give the gold medal to the industry that needed the most encouragement. Vine Growers Association. For many California vintners, the Fruit Growers Association that had been established was not meeting their needs. Wine production was exploding in California. The gallons of wine produced had doubled in just a couple years. 1868, 1.88 million gallons. 1869, 2.64 million gallons. 1870, 3.8 million gallons. 1871, estimated 5.7 million gallons. The average wholesale price for wine was 30 cents to 50 cents per gallon, and California land devoted to grapevines had blossomed to 20 million acres. In 1872, vintners decided to organize a Vine Growers Association. A group of California vintners assembled in Sacramento in early February 1872 to launch the organization. B.D. Wilson of Los Angeles was elected president. A. Shell and Bugbee were elected vice presidents of the new organization called the Vine Growers and Wine and Brandy Manufacturers Association. Bugbee was part of the committee for establishing a permanent organization, along with A. Shell of Stanislaus County, George Applegate, J. R. Nickerson, and T. R. Chamberlain of Placer County, C. J. Carpenter of El Dorado County, A. Heberhart of San Francisco, George Johnston of Sacramento, I. N. Hogue of Yolo County, J. H. Cooper of Santa Barbara County, and William Caldwell of Sonoma County. Bugbee would also serve on committees reporting on the association's constitution and bylaws, cultivation of the grape and pruning, and on the making and clarification of wine. The most pressing issue for Bugbee was not the cultivation of grapevines, but the reduction of the federal tax on brandy. He proposed a committee to immediately work on drafting a memorandum to be sent to Congress to reduce the onerous tax. He entreated his fellow delegates, "I suppose the idea of appointing this committee is that they shall, in the name of this convention and the grape growers of the state of California, petition our legislature to join with us in a memorial to Congress, praying that the revenue on brandy made from the grape exclusively be reduced. I do not think there is any possibility of our urging the matter too strongly. Prompt action is required in this case. The other committees can report at their leisure. But this is a matter that won't bear delay, but must be attended to immediately." There was not a great urgency among Bugbee's fellow members to tackle a federal taxation issue. The matter was directed to a committee for further study. The Vine Growers meeting was held in Sacramento, which was a short train and buggy ride out to Bugbee's Natoma Vineyard. Before the Vine Growers Conventions commenced, Bugbee held a large party to dedicate one of the huge wine vats that he had constructed. It was capable of holding 50,000 gallons of wine and made for a suitable dance floor as well. Guests were invited to dance inside the wine vats. The wooden vats were lit up, and Bugbee hired musicians to play dancing tunes, which must have included Bugbee's Champagne Gallop and Bugbee's Champagne Waltz. The Vine Growers Association would continue to meet almost on a monthly basis, except for George Johnston's discussion on fusel oil being driven off at different temperatures in the manufacture of brandy. Most of the reports and discussion were drawn from growers' experience. For example, one topic was whether grapes farthest from the main stock were less sweet. Bugbee said he never detected a difference. Another discussion centered on J.R. Nickerson's assessment that the white Malaga made a good wine grape and would not crack or mildew. Bugbee confirmed Nickerson's experience and only added that his white Malaga grapes would crack after a rainstorm. Lobbying for land relief. At the time the vine growers were meeting, the California State Assembly was considering a bill to change how water canal companies must compensate landowners for constructing flumes across their land. One of the provisions of AB 269 was that the condemnation of land by a water canal company for the construction of a flume must adhere to the same procedures as land condemnations by the railroad companies. Specifically, the water canal company would have to deposit a sufficient amount of money into an account to cover any damages to the property owner. Once this was done, the work could move forward. Bugbee had been awarded $19,000 by the El Dorado District Court for the loss of property resulting from the construction of the Natoma Water and Mining Company flume across Browns Ravine. Several years after the court decision, he was still waiting to be compensated. Bugbee complained to his local elected officials about how the bill might further delay his receipt of the awarded monetary compensation from the Natoma Water and Mining Company. The political lines were clearly drawn between assemblymen who favored the canal companies and their ability to expand operations, and fellow assembly members who favored property owners and their rights to be compensated in a timely manner. Assemblyman Day summarized the effect of California's existing law as the water canal company's ability to keep condemnation compensation locked up in litigation until finally adjudicated by the Supreme Court. And that was exactly what was happening to Bugbee. The Natoma Water and Mining Company was appealing the decision to award Bugbee compensation for the property they condemned for their water flume. Many of the water ditches constructed in California after the onset of the gold rush occurred before any land surveys were taken. In most instances, the water ditch was in place before the federal government recognized a settler's claim to the land through the public land survey system. In April 1872, AB 781 was introduced and summarized as an act for the relief and protection of agricultural interests in El Dorado County. The focus of the bill was to force water ditch companies who had the power to condemn property to keep and repair crossings over the ditch at their own expense. One of the provisions of the bill was that if an award for the condemnation of property was not paid in 12 months, the water ditch company would forfeit all rights to the property. Assemblyman French noted that the forfeiture provision was directly aimed at the Natoma Water and Mining Company's dispute with Bugbee and was meant to affect a case pending in court. French argued, quote, "Mr. Bugbee bought out somebody else's place. A short time ago, a dispute arose between Mr. Bugbee and the ditch company owing to some pipes or water, resulting in a case in court, which had now got into the Supreme Court," unquote. The assembly would pass an amended version stipulating that the provision of the bill would not apply to any water ditch that was in operation 10 years prior to the passage of the act. Bugbee's attempt to settle the Natoma Water and Mining Company's litigation outside of the court had failed. Assemblyman French was a landowner in Sacramento County, a friend to and fellow mason of Bugbee. It must have stung Bugbee that a longtime friend would not support his cause against the much larger Natoma Water and Mining Company. Death of Peter McClashan. In the spring of 1872, Peter McClashan, the father of Bugbee's second wife, Nettie, died on April 18th. Before he died on April 17th, he recorded his last will and testament. To his eldest daughter, Elizabeth, who was living in Healdsburg, Sonoma County, he left all his property in Sonoma County. To Martinette Nettie Bugbee, he bequeathed the land he had acquired in El Dorado County. The property was most of the Duroc vineyard that Bugbee had bought in 1863 and delineated under the meets and bounds system of property description. After the government land surveys were completed, mapping California, excluding Mexican and Spanish land grants, into townships and ranges based on the public land survey system, Bugbee sold 40 acres of the Duroc Vineyard property near Shingle Springs to George Bayless for $60. George Bayless was the son-in-law of Peter McClashan and married to Peter's daughter Adelia. On June 22, 1870, George Bayless bought 160 acres from the Central Pacific Railroad Company for $200. This was also land that encompassed the Duroc Vineyard. 4 days later, he sold the land that he bought from the Central Pacific Railroad and Bugbee to Peter McClashan, a total of 200 acres for $60. The next month, on July 26, Peter McClashan gifted all 200 acres to his daughter, Nettie. By 1870, Bugby had already been involved in protracted litigation with the Natoma Water and Mining Company over his Natoma Vineyard property, consolidating the Duroc Vineyard property through Peter McClashan and ultimately to his wife Nettie may have been his way of protecting that property under his control without his outright ownership of it. The bequeath of the property to Nettie was duplicative of his prior gift that was duly recorded. Economic changes. As 1872 progressed, Bugby remained active in politics and chairman of the Sacramento County Republican Party. He presided over a large meeting in front of the Orleans Hotel in Sacramento to ratify the nominations for the Philadelphia Convention to support President Grant. Also active in the Republican Party at the county that year were old friends and past foes, such as James McClatchy, George Cadwallader, A.P. Catlin, and A. Heilbron. The spirits produced by the Natoma Vineyard weren't sold just for their taste. They were also sold to the Sacramento County Hospital. Alcohol had its medicinal value in the 1870s. Bugby was selling his wines and brandy to the county hospital as stimulants. His monthly sales ranged from $87 up to $238 every month. A management audit stated that most of the wine and brandies used for stimulants came almost exclusively from the Natoma Vineyard. The supply of stimulants to the patients, the audit concluded, appeared to be exceedingly liberal. At the 1872 State Fair, the California Vine Growers and Wine and Brandy Manufacturers Association awarded Bugby a premium for his 1869 Grape Brandy and for his Red Burgundy Vintage 1871, but 10 of his other entries garnered no premiums or awards. He did exhibit Japanese chestnuts that he was growing at the Natoma Vineyard, for which he was awarded a special recommendation. He also displayed a model of George Johnson's brandy still at the fair. Through the first 9 months of 1872, California wineries had shipped more than 749,000 gallons of wine through San Francisco, either by rail or steamship. Many wineries were having record production years. Gerke Wines in Tehama was estimated to produce 125,000 gallons of wine and similar amount for G. Grosinger of Yountville. Plus, many of these wineries had a like amount of previous vintages in storage. Bugby's Natoma Vineyard was 125 acres, similar to the size of G. Grosinger's, but Bugby was only producing between 70,000 and 80,000 gallons of wine. While wholesale wine prices were holding steady at about 50 cents per gallon, brandy was hovering between $1.25 and $1.50 per gallon before federal excise taxes. Bugby had earlier estimated that each gallon of brandy he produced with the Johnston Still would sell for $3 per gallon. Railroad freight rates were upwards of $2.70 per 100 pounds for shipping back to the East Coast. That was if the wine or brandy was shipped in a wooden container. The winery had to add on an additional dollar to the rates if the product was in a bottle. A 750-milliliter bottle of wine could weigh as much as 3 pounds. This meant California wine producers would have to add as much as 10 cents per bottle of wine to ship it back east, while the shipping cost was much lower per gallon if shipped in large wooden barrels. It was still a premium that cut into the profitability. The unfolding story in the California wine market in 1872 was that production was increasing, prices were flat, and expenses were increasing. The net revenue for some vintners was also decreasing if they sold their products into markets where they were paid in greenbacks and not gold, because federally backed paper money was discounted in California. All of this was squeezing Bugby's cash flow, as he had leveraged the Natoma Vineyard to expand operations and invest in George Johnston's Brandy Distillery Company.